Thank you for downloading the Demimonde podcast. We are covering the television series Penny Dreadful. This podcast is brought to you by No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
And I'm your host, Paul.
And if you love this podcast, if you like this podcast, you can head over to iTunes and write us a review. If you're shy, you can click on some stars. Another way to support us is to go to our website at noship.net, and you can look at our contact page and you can communicate with us. As you have heard, we like to share email.
We're feedback junkies.
Yeah.
Feed us.
Yes.
Give us our smack.
Yes.
We also have an Amazon link. If that's a nice way to support us, and it doesn't cost you anything extra, just go to noship.net, click on the Amazon link. It takes you to the Amazon homepage, and then from there you can do your shopping as usual. And like I said, it doesn't cost you anything, but you know, we get a little bit of a kickback for buttercream torts and things like that.
And equipment, ridiculous amounts of equipment.
That too, yeah.
Yeah.
We buy microphones and...
We want redundant equipment.
Bulldozers.
Unnecessary equipment.
Yeah.
Bulldozers, yeah.
Backhoe.
Oh, a bulldozer would be so much fun to drive.
Mm-hmm. I've been eyeing this pretty sweet cement mixer. And if we get Amazon Prime, that shipping is free.
Yeah, and don't forget about Paul's contest.
Yeah, and all the stuff we just mentioned actually goes right along with it. So by helping us, you could possibly help yourself. And on a small update, it's finished. I'm firing it on Friday.
Yay!
Cool. Yes, I got everything on it. It'll be a surprise once I get it all done. I'm not going to tell anything about it on air, but... I got it all done and finished, so now we just need to get it fired. So a week and a half, and it'll be completely done. You'll get to see it on Twitter. It's hopefully, knock on wood, everything comes out.
He showed us some pictures on Friday, and it looks really cool.
It looks really cool.
Thanks. Hopefully,
it's going to be awesome.
Hopefully, it's going to finish out nicely.
Yay. All right. Yeah. Cool. So, any thoughts on this episode before we go into recap?
I loved it. I fucking love this episode. This show just keeps getting better and better. I liked it better than the last episode. And I think it provided a great contrast in the sense that last episode was really heavy, really like furrowed brow seriousness. Mm-hmm. And this episode had a lot of lighthearted moments in it. There was some banter. There was some humor. There was a little bit of love in the air. There's a lot of stuff going on in this episode, but it still brought the dark. So
I enjoyed it. Probably my least favorite of the season, though.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it was good. The ending was fantastic. Maybe you guys, as we talk, will help change my mind like last week. Last week I thought was good, and I thought it was even better when we were done. So you never know.
You need us to tell you how good it is. Look.
Well, just discussing it and kind of making me see some of the things that I missed. I don't know. I think I wanted a little more. We got a lot of meat and potatoes this episode on a few different characters again. Just kind of got a little more intimate with a few. So I enjoyed it. I like that. I mean, I'll talk about it as we go along, but we finally hit, you know, a couple different characters that I wasn't expecting to see so quickly. So I enjoyed it. I'm not knocking it, but if I had to watch any episode so far again, it wouldn't even be in the top three because the other episodes were so much better in my opinion.
Hmm.
You know, I'm not saying it was awful. It's just not my favorite.
Cool. What'd you think?
I really like this episode. This episode had a lot of really good moments. But let's go ahead and get into the episode and... Everything will be brought forth as far as what I thought. Okay, so we are discussing Penny Dreadful Episode 4, which is titled Evil Spirits in Heavenly Places, which is written by John Logan and directed by Damon Thomas. The episode opens with Ives concluding the story of the cut wife to Malcolm Murray. She is telling them as Ethan has requested. Dr. Frankenstein, Sembene, and Ferdinand Lyle are also present in the room, and Dr. Frankenstein is ever the skeptic.
This is why rewatching is really good. I watched this episode twice in a row, which I guess is becoming a habit for this season of Penny Dreadful. And you notice so much more because the banter and the, not really the banter, but just the dialogue just goes from person to person to person so quickly that sometimes you miss what's being said. And so, you know, rewatching it really helped out because there's a lot here. They're just, you know, going, shooting off their opinions and what they're thinking about really quickly.
Well, I like it how the Dreadful's like, in some shows, you would have just those two holding those secrets together till it's too late. I like that they sat down and told the whole group the story.
Right.
You know? So now we can put the pieces together. They work well together.
It was a good segue. It was a really good segue because she started off telling him, and then she ends it telling everybody. Like, and then she kind of explains and said, this is why Ethan wanted you guys to know, because ABC.
Was there anything specific that was said? Because you brought up the dialogue going from person to person and there being a lot there. Was there anything that caught your attention? That
it's just how they're not about egos and having to be right. They're trying to get to the bottom of a problem. So when Frankenstein, you know, as the skeptic, like you pointed out, is kind of saying stuff like, well, yeah, but, you know, witches are just stories. They're not walking around in the streets of Greater London. And she's like, well, these are. And he's like, okay, I take your point. And then they move on. They don't try to – the dialogue doesn't get speed bumped by people's personalities. They kind of – everything has to be like it just – I don't know. It has this smooth flow with the plot and the dialogue, unlike what I'm saying right now, which is not very smooth. But you know what I mean. You know
yes,
what I'm getting
we
at.
Get
no,
here.
Absolutely.
I think that was like his last shred of skepticism just got blown away there because there's another conversation that happens soon after this.
Well, how could you be a skeptic at this point with all that they've seen?
It's a good question.
Yeah. Stories do that a lot. Movies and books and TV shows and everything. They'll have people be a skeptic and they just kind of have this character as a skeptic. And they stay that way the whole time, no matter what they see. So it's kind of time for Victor to step out of that skepticism frame of mind and just be like, all right, this shit is real and it's going down right in front of my eyes.
Yeah. I mean, dude, you animated a body.
Yeah.
Why else could be surprising to you at this point?
Well, he thinks that's science. So he's going to attribute that to science where everything else is more myth and lore.
I see. That makes sense. That makes sense.
But
I agree with that.
But he has seen vampires.
And he has seen a possessed woman.
Yeah, and he's rationalized it in some way to help help support his skepticism. He just probably
to be able to go to bed at night, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah.
I mean, that demon plucked the idea of Caliban right out of his head and told it to him in season one. How do you account for that?
Yeah, you can't.
Perhaps he thinks it's some sort of science we just haven't figured out yet, and that's why he's okay with it. But
Mr. Lyle leads him over to the pieces that make up the multilinguistic puzzle. The languages are a mix of Latin, Arabic, Sumerian, and 10 other languages and pictographs, changing language from relic to relic. And it turns out that the narrative is from the perspective of a devil, one of the legion that was cast from heaven. They don't know enough yet to say it's Lucifer, but Lyle calls it the memoirs of the devil.
This is a really nifty idea, I think, to go from one language to another in this, like, it really is a puzzle. And you have to figure it out. But I mean, who in the fuck would be smart enough to do that? I guess it took all of them to figure it out.
It's genius.
Yeah.
It really is. It's a genius way to do it. Otherwise, you'd have a bunch of – it would be harder to explain them translating the devil's language. You know, this way, it's all a bunch of ancient languages that you have enough people in the room like they do. It makes it easier for them to tell the story instead of us going, how the fuck did they know the devil's tongue? You know what I mean? It's pretty smart on the director's part.
I like Lyle's accent.
Oh, yeah.
The way he pronounces his R's are like W's. And my first like hourly paid job was in England, and one of my bosses was from Leeds. And he sounded like that. Like his R's sounded like W's. And I'm wondering if that's like a regional thing.
It's a regional thing.
A regional. My wheel. My wheel. I had it whiffed.
Marriage.
Is what brings us here together today. Okay.
Two of.
So now Ives walks Dr. Frankenstein out of the room and he's about to leave. He says he does not believe things are impossible anymore. In fact, things are most likely worse than you can imagine. Ives suggests also that they could be better. And he asks her if she really believes this to be so. And she says that she chooses to. I think this is important because this may be tested this season, so she may not be believing in things being better by the end of the season. Hopefully not. Mm-hmm. But if Steve's theory is right that everybody's going to get twisted on the inside, you know, that's might be
well,
she might lose that kind
that
of hope.
I don't think people in the group are going to die yet. I think that they're going to get tortured.
Yeah.
No, we're going to have a death. One person's going to die. Just settle with it now, and you'll be okay when it happens. Just remember, I'll be cheering.
So Dr. Frankenstein asks Ives to accompany him on an errand in the morning, and she gladly accepts this invitation without knowing where they will be going.
Now, what is Ives thinking this is? Seriously.
It's an adventure.
What?
Just an adventure?
Well, I don't know, because she says this is the last thing I expected.
What would you expect if you asked Dr. Frankenstein asked you for a favor?
Maybe to help go by surgical instruments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could see that. Something from the occult, maybe. You know, that makes sense. I need some occult protection. Let's go to a store for it, maybe.
Because now he's believing things are possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be plausible.
I have no idea. I didn't really give any thought to that because I think that when she says, this is the last thing that I expected, I think that's kind of like a generic response that people give.
Yeah.
When they say,
that's true.
This is, I would have never guessed this, would probably be a more appropriate thing to say, but it doesn't carry the same interesting quote type quality as,
yeah,
this is the last thing I would have expected. But what she did expect, who knows with Dr. Frankenstein?
Yeah.
He's a mystery.
Well.
Maybe she expected cocaine.
Yeah.
Get fucked up. They just start bar hopping.
So after Dr. Frankenstein departs, she turns and she sees Sembene sitting on the stairs. She asks, what is he doing? And he says, watching. Those things that hunt at night. Lions. Outside, we see Hecate. She's watching the Murray estate while standing next to a lion statue from a nearby rooftop.
Awesome. Awesome. Much respect for Sembene. He's the only one that's thinking... Is everybody just going to put their PJs on and go to bed?
Yep, apparently. Yeah.
You know, we're dealing with night sisters. Night.
Guess what time it is?
Night.
And one thing around this point I thought, and I probably could bring it up later, is why didn't she ward the house they're living in now?
With the scorpion?
Yeah. Why did she not, like, hook the house up with some protection spells?
Huh. Hmm.
That's a good question.
Maybe she has, and they just haven't revealed it yet. But then you're right, mm-hmm. how they've come inside, so obviously there's no ward. So what am I saying?
Maybe she's not strong enough, or maybe the demon inside. I don't know. Maybe the demon inside her won't let her. I don't know.
Maybe it's because it's not her house, but probably there's going to be a reason that surfaces sometime. But right now it's more convenient to the plot that they're able to, you know, to just come into the house and do whatever they're going to do.
Well, it's not like she's thinking like a witch because, I mean, how much time did she really spend with a cut wife? Do you think she really got that much knowledge where she could actually employ it in a way where a witch who's actually had the proper training would do it?
Actually, to answer this question, we saw the preview for next week's episode, and Ethan is talking about using everything that they have in their repertoire, superstition, spells, what have you. And you do see the scorpion a little, I think,
for a second.
So I think she does do what Paul's saying. Eventually. And she does ward the house.
Okay.
So that might be the last time we see that kind of incursion.
Maybe she'll go and get the devil's diary and open it finally.
Oh, that's going to be like the last two episodes.
Fine.
It'll get here before you know it. And then you'll be missing the show. God damn it, I wish Penny Dreadful was still on. Oh, that's how I feel. You miss it already.
At the end of every episode, you miss it. It's like, I guess I'll wait a week.
Yeah.
I'm too used to binging shows now. No. It's awful.
Netflix has spoiled everybody.
So Inspector Rusk views the crime scene on the train. The parents that Hecate had murdered in episode 2 are what he's looking at. There were no witnesses to the crime. And Rusk wonders, how did the killer come and go carrying a baby? The wounds are precise and delicate, unlike the animal butchery they have seen. He quickly concludes that magic is involved. It's a bit of a leap, I think, but I'm not sure how Victorian Londoners thought about magic in general at that time. Or is there more to Inspector Rusk that we still have yet to learn? Maybe he has a history with the demimonde.
He could, for sure. I have a little more respect for him, just in the fact that even before he said magic, just that he noticed how different the killings were. You know, because most Jamooks would be like, oh, well, you know, it's just the same guy that's just doing this, you know, a different type of killing. So it's nice that he's taking the time to actually, come after the Dreadfuls. I think eventually he's going to come after them. You know, he's going to start putting the pieces together, and he's going to be like that reporter in the old Incredible Hulk TV show, you know, that was always getting in the way. He's going to be like that. He's just always going to he's going to get in the way at some point.
You think he might like pin that particular crime on Dr. Frankenstein because of the surgical precision?
Who knows? I mean, he could be so obsessed with getting his man that, you know, he gets involved, or they bring him into the fold and then they can pretty much do whatever they want because they can cover it up.
I also thought this well, speaking to that, I think there might be some collusion later on, because this guy is, if he's going to be like the Sherlock Holmes kind of archetype character, mm-hmm. he's going to be smart enough to realize if he comes into contact or conflict with the Dreadfuls that they're not bad. that they're trying to do. They're trying to fight the forces of darkness that he's trying to fight as well. And he's not really that innocent of a person, because I don't know exactly what grinding you to bone entails, but yeah, that was a pretty stout threat he gave to that guy. But other than that, those points, I think that there's a second thing to this scene, and it's letting us know that the person who did the killings at the beginning of season one, the murders and stuff like that, that they were searching for, is not, obviously, we don't think it's Ethan anymore, but it's not the Nightcomers either.
Right.
So there's a third force at work here.
Well, I figured that already. It's Dorian Gray.
Well, there you have it, folks. It's story problem solved.
Done and done.
Well, I think we all knew that it wasn't either one of them, but I think this scene gives it, to me, a pretty firm capstone on that theory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Do you agree?
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, absolutely.
So now the Putneys debate the worth of opening up another exhibit. The conversation continues, and when he's convincing her, he says, besides this, with this, we are not simulating anything. There's going to be flesh and blood and pumping hearts. And then he says this exhibition is going to be kept in the cellar because they don't need light. They are freaks. So what's he planning to do with Caliban, and who mm-hmm. else are the freaks? Because this is plural.
There's no telling.
They've got people. They've got some sort of mutated mm-hmm. poor souls down there that they're going to use as part of their exhibits, and they're going to convince the public that it's fake, but it's going to be real, so it'll look shocking. It's damn.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. I mean, the Hunchback, I don't know. It's wrong city. I mean, there's no telling what he's got down there.
Well, I have a theory.
Sweet.
Based on the Elephant Man. He came to fame around 1884. He was featured in a freak show, which was positioned across the street from the London Hospital. So doctors would come over and students would come over and look. And then eventually the doctors took him over, John Merrick, to be examined. And also at this time in Victorian times, late Victorian period, 1891, the freak show thing is losing favor because more and more people are educated about diseases and conditions like that, and they have more empathy for the people mm-hmm. who are involved. So my theory is based on this. I think somebody's going to come over and look at him. It's going to be a doctor, and he's going to want to examine Caliban.
Oh.
And that's going to fuck some shit up for Victor. And I think, you know, because awesome. They kind of play around with Victorian ideas and themes, but they do their own spin on it.
Do you think they could hold him, though?
No.
I mean, he's so strong. Are they going to be able to actually hold him, or are they just going to convince him just to kind of play along?
Unless they promise him something.
Like their daughter? Mm-hmm.
If there's some sort of carrot on the stick that may or may not even be plausible, but they're going to use it anyway. Caliban's in trouble.
It's the poo-poo Putneys back in action.
As D. Cody coined them, so they are now forever the poo-poo Putneys.
Poo-poo Putneys.
That's what I was thinking when I was watching it last night. I was just like, the poo-poo Putneys. And then Em was like, I was thinking the same thing.
That's awesome.
It just fits.
So we see Caliban. He's having a conversation with with Lavinia. Mm-hmm. And they discuss how to age Mr. Gladstone. And Mr. Gladstone, by the way, is the prime minister during this time. And she's talking about how the trick to age these wax creations is the eyes. And then she asks him the color of his eyes. He finally, after some whimpering and resistance, he finally fesses up that they are yellow. And she does not respond with alarm, but with a matter-of-factness that is kind of like a hug for Caliban. They continue to talk about the wax creations, especially about the murder victims. She feels that she is torturing them all over again, like terrible African voodoo dolls. He talks of life being born fresh and then tortured, that's everybody's experience in life. But mm-hmm. now he may not be thinking like that anymore, and I think we're led to believe it's because he's met her. So he's got hope, like she is his hope.
Two girls in his life.
Yeah, but I'm worried about her because the fact that she seems to embody his hope, I'm worried that she could be exactly.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be bad.
But I think it's interesting that she says African voodoo dolls. So I think that's supposed to point to the puppets that we saw with Evelyn Poole. And, mm-hmm. and maybe that also points to something Malcolm Murray knows that we don't know he knows. And also Senbene. Mm-hmm. So they're going to have more tricks up their sleeves to fight Evelyn Poole and her powers.
Oh, that's genius.
Yeah, they definitely have something in their arsenal that's going to be up to what she has.
Well, after this scene, I see Caliban as like a teenager. I don't know why, but in my head, just by the way he acts, by the way he takes compliments, how he's kind of still awkward. I don't know. The actor is like in his 40s, but just the way that they're portraying him and everything, he just seems like a teenager to me, you know, full of love, but at the same time, full of despair. He looks like a goth teenager. I don't know why.
Like how he gets startled by somebody he can actually see in the room?
No, just just by his reactions, you know, just to people themselves, because he's so guarded. And if you think about it mentally, how old is he from being born again? You know, how many years?
You're right. I know. And I'm glad you're saying this because it's helping me recalibrate. So I'm not so hard on him.
I actually love the character because of it. Once I saw him that way, this whole season, I've been great with him. Last season, I mean, it was like, okay, whatever, it's Frankenstein. But this season, it takes a whole different turn for me to where I actually enjoy the scenes that he's in, because think of him as a goth teenager and it's like, all right, you know, he's just uncomfortable. He's getting
pulling
his pukes.
Sleeves up past his fingers.
Yeah. I mean, it fits. I mean, he's got the hair. He dresses in black. He's, you know, he reads poetry probably in a dark room.
Mm-hmm. And smokes a cigarette or two, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody hates me, but I have love.
They don't know what's in my heart. And if I kill myself, they'll never know.
Yeah, put him at a Manson concert, nobody would know. Nobody would know.
I don't forget the things that he's done, but at the same time, I'm watching his character development really eagerly because I want to see what he's going to become. And not to bring everything back to some sort of comic book reference or whatever, but I feel like he's going to be the muscle in this group. He's going to be like the thing. He's like, it's clobbering time. And he's going to be able to just put the hurting on some of these supernatural entities that they can't really get at in a physical way because they're just normal humans. Them being the other dreadfuls.
Yeah. I mean, right now, I'd rather watch his storyline than Dorian Gray. I mean, we're at least getting something about him. Yeah, because, what did Dorian do this episode?
We'll talk about
Swooned
it in just
somebody.
A minute.
Well, if those are voodoo dolls that she has in that room with her and they're all active, think about the amount of people that Evelyn Poole can actually control.
Somebody,
you know what I mean?
Somebody wrote in, it might have been Decody, I'm not sure, but somebody wrote in and talked about that a couple episodes back when that aired. They were like, who else is under her thumb?
Yeah, it could be a lot. It could be that cop.
Yeah.
I did look at voodoo dolls. The main thing they suggest, the person you're representing is you want to get a piece of that person's hair in the doll. Voodoo dolls can and, in fact, are widely used for sinister purposes. If you have the voodoo doll of an enemy, you can use it to cause him severe pain and even death. For this, the doll is pricked with nails to cause pain and bound and hung with rope. But remember, using a doll for evil purposes has horrible consequences, since the person using the doll may suffer badly and even die for dark voodoo practices.
Ooh.
So there's a cost, supposedly, according to what?
Is there a... Don't use a voodoo doll for anything wrong. Is there a good voodoo doll?
Yeah.
Yeah, apparently there is. I just didn't copy and paste that part.
some good voodoo yoga, you know? Oh, I feel like stretching today. I don't know.
Maybe you can influence somebody's health. Like, you can encourage their limbic system to work better.
Or you could, like, you could
voodoo
make,
sex doll.
That's what I was going to say. Like, maybe you make a voodoo doll and you just jerk it off and give somebody a random
you don't
orgasm
need Viagra,
right in the middle
just
of the
get
day.
A voodoo doll.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Hold on, I need to get my doll one sec.
That's hot.
If the doll's up, I'm up. That's how it works.
All right. Ethan is walking the London streets and sees the advertisement for the Mariners Inn massacre at Putney's. He grabs a paper featuring Hecate's own murderous work, maybe, I think, for distraction. She is present and spies him from not so far away, and her compatriots prick a horse and it sets a stage for her to be rescued by Ethan. She throws herself into his arms after the event, and she weeps.
Sly dogs. That's all there is to that. Sly.
She's not very sly, actually.
Well, I mean, I thought he fell for it.
He fell for it. I think he didn't realize this. It's a different scene, and we'll get to it when we get to it. But I don't think he knew something was amiss until he started talking to her. One American talking to an English woman who was trying to sound like an American. And there was little nuggets in there that made us, like, I'll just wait till we get to that scene. But
she smelt wrong, when he hugged her.
Maybe she farted.
That might be why. But she does say later to Evelyn that he smelled me. So, and Sarah Duncan Power, because I thought on first watch, I thought he kind of like looked back when she throws herself into his arms. He does this kind of deal. And I thought it was because, whoa, the drama. Calm down, lady. You know, but now I think it's because he got a whiff of her and he's just like, whoa, what's this?
You could smell the evil.
I don't know what he's. Yeah, because he assumes that she's working for his dad. So I don't think he's honed his sense of smell. I don't think he's aware of his full powers. You know, in fact, he's in constant denial of it. So he's not exploring it.
Yeah. That sense of smell would be annoying. No squeaking a fart by him, you know? You're in a group, there's a party, he'd probably be like, hey, none of that. Hold it till you leave, please.
Go in the other room.
Go. Jesus, like, makes you go.
So Rusk meets with Mr. Roper at the hospital, and he asks Mr. Roper to describe what happened at the Mariner's Inn. Mr. Roper is not forthcoming by claiming not to remember. Inspector Rusk asks why he was wearing a gun, and Mr. Roper says for protection. And then Inspector Rusk threatens Mr. Roper, but Mr. Roper is not intimidated.
Not at all. He just pulls out. He's like, I'm an American, and I know my rights, and once I get out of this bed, I'm out of this city. Fuck you.
Yeah. So, I mean, werewolf, I don't know yet.
He was saying, like, the wounds on you appeared to be either claw marks or possibly, or, you know, a tomahawks or some other strange American weapon.
Like, is he going to turn into a werewolf? His eye still looks kind of funky. And how powerful is Ethan's dad that he's that not going to give up any information at all because he doesn't want Ethan caught?
Well,
tear off half of my face. I'll lead you right to him.
I'm going to give up a lot of information. Especially if I could do it before you tear off half of my face. But, you know, even the other way around, I'm not going to be too sympathetic to your cause. So something's scaring this guy.
Mm-hmm. The witches of Eastwick are going to take him and turn him against him. That's why. That's their werewolf. I'm telling you. They're going to snatch him up.
That's a good theory. Right. I think we discussed this last time because they get divided into teams.
Yeah.
And then your team, somebody, or team, Ethan.
Yeah. That's right, because we were talking about Twilight. Okay, moving on. Ives and Dr. Frankenstein shop for women's clothing. He tells her his second cousin Lily is coming to town. He specifies second.
Yeah, when she was thinking, by second cousin, do you mean you?
Do you need to try on these panties, Victor?
It's totally fine. We'll still be friends.
He describes Lily as being simple and needing help with dressing for the city. Ives offers suggestions for a fair-haired, ample-bosomed woman. Dr. Frankenstein is not sure about the décolletage.
He doesn't want
it to be too revealing because he describes Ives as being with her collars and being completely dressed. Which is interesting because the first time he comes calling over to the Murray estate, Malcolm Murray asks Ives to unbutton her collar before she greets him down the stairs. Anyway, so he also invites Ives for tea with himself and Lily. Ives, I think, might recognize her because she did meet
her. From the opera?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or the play.
Oh, I forgot all about that. He doesn't know, does he?
No, he doesn't know.
Oh, Victor.
And then Ives reminds Dr. Frankenstein about the undergarments.
She's having a good time with that.
Yeah, she is.
You know, she knows she's making him feel a little bit uncomfortable with that. So she's just like, look at this underwear.
And she catches him a couple times too because she's like, how do you know exactly how tall your cousin is and that she has an ample bosom? It's a little creepy.
Mm-hmm. He's like, she's approximately 5'5" or something like that. You know, and
exactly. That's precise. Well, yeah. She is having a lot of fun, and this is a break from all the, you know, seriousness that she's constantly immersed in.
This is one of the reasons why this episode is such a good contrast from the last episode. They're both great, but you can't keep running at the same emotional level the whole time with the show. You have to have your peaks and your valleys to give the contrast and dynamics to everything, and they're doing a masterful job of that.
It's true.
I agree.
Oh, do you?
I do. All right, so now we have Hecate spinning a tale to Ethan. And I wrote upon rewatch, he looks suspicious from the very beginning. And I'm not an actor, but I think he does a good job here because it seems like it's a very subtle thing you have to portray, and he does it really well. When you,
I like him as an actor. When I really do.
Yeah, when you go back and watch it and you know he's suspicious, you can see it. It's evident.
Sweet. I'm going to rewatch it actually tomorrow evening, so it's perfect.
In fact, I think he wipes that smudge off her face to see how she would react to him, you know, suddenly reaching over her and touching her face. And she, you know, she pulls back in fear for a second. And he then thinks she's been hired by either his father or the Pinkertons, which the Pinkertons are associated with his father, right?
Right.
And he says he's all for the Pinkertons hiring women because he is for emancipation. So, which was interesting that that was thrown in there because what we have the scene with Lily later. But.
Yeah, it's a theme of this episode for sure. This is a feminist show. We'll get back to that.
Wait, you know, what?
Later on.
I'm out.
Yeah.
Damn it.
It really is. It really is.
But, yeah, absolutely. Well, Ethan's always the gentleman. He really is.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. But I think there's plenty of gentlemen, quote unquote, that were around at that time who didn't believe in that kind of stuff. But I think he actually honestly feels that way. You know, he's behind it. I'm not saying you don't. I'm just saying.
No, like, absolutely. But he's a gentleman. I mean, anything he does, he's always putting women ahead of himself, you know?
We've seen the women he's attracted to. Brona, she was very honest and, you know, strong in personality. And Ives is also a strong woman, so he's all for it.
Ives was a better choice. But
now, do you think by giving the witches this information about his dad, do they use that against him possibly down the road?
Interesting.
Maybe they contact
call.
His father.
Yeah.
And get his father there, and they take him away, and then you don't have your werewolf to deal with anymore. Lupus Day. Sorry, I keep calling him fucking werewolf, but you know what I mean.
Well, he is a werewolf. He's just part
of the...
You're
mumbling there. I'm like, what was that?
He's supposedly part of the Lupus Day order.
Yes. Yes.
But I like the scene because she's trying to talk like she's from Maine, and she's English, so she doesn't have the accents right, and she sounds just like a Midwesterner. Just like a typical Midwesterner, the way she says some of the words.
Yeah.
Like somebody who would be from, you know, Wisconsin or Michigan or something like that. And that's where it goes off in his head probably, you know.
Doesn't
more
sound
than
like Wisconsin
else.
Or Michigan. Maybe more like Indiana.
Yes.
Okay, sure. Or she's affecting an accent that's from a certain part of the country that's definitely not New England. That's all I was getting
at. So, do you want to complete your thought about that? Did you?
I thought I did.
All right. So now there's a puppet show, which could be Punch and Judy, even though it doesn't look like Punch and Judy. Okay, so this opens up the next scene. Angelique and Dorian talk of their names. Angelique asks his age, and he responds with, he's an older than he looks, but he doesn't give his age. Dorian does not care that they are being stared at. Provocation is like food and drink to him. And then he takes Angelique on an adventure. And he was taking her to the Gossamer Parlor, what did you think it was before they walked in?
I thought it was just another dirty place to go hang out. I mean, who knows with Dorian Gray? It could have been a donkey show. I don't know.
That's what they wanted you to think.
Yeah.
Is that it was going to be something like that. It was going to be some sort of sexual thing where they were going to go in and there's going to be people hanging from the rafters by their nipple clamps and, you know, stuff like that. Just all kinds of outlier fetish kind of stuff. And then it's ping pong.
It was cool to see. And they talk about, like, the lighting being electric. You know, it was an enjoyable scene. I still want more of Dorian Gray. That's not just him swooning somebody.
We're going to talk a little bit about Dorian Gray when we get to feedback.
Finally. I've been waiting all day for this.
I'll just say this. Yeah, I like this scene because there was no sexuality to it. They had a kiss, but it wasn't a bedroom scene. There wasn't any nudity. There wasn't anything like that. Not that I mind those things in the least, but I feel like it was an honest step towards establishing a relationship between these two characters rather than just showing the carnality of these two characters.
Yeah.
And that's important because they're connecting on a level, regardless of their sex and gender, they're connecting on a level and they're working. And I think this character is going to have significance because of the Lyle connection that we talked about a couple episodes ago. And so I know you want to see more of his character, but I think it is the baby steps of getting to that.
We're talking some serious baby steps. I mean, two seasons of him. I'll give the guy credit. He's a pimp. He knows how to treat a lady and a guy, but I just want more from it. I mean, we're even getting more from Frankenstein. I mean, I just want a little bit, just a little bit, and I would totally drop it. You know what I mean? The scene was great. I like the character they brought in for him. It's fun, especially when you see ping pong in Victorian times. I mean, that's pretty freaking hilarious. You know, that there was parlors for ping pong. And, you know, there was some funny jokes in between. It was a light scene. I just want to – just a smidge. Smidge. Just give me a smidge.
Well, they had lawn tennis that was really popular. And so they were trying to take advantage of that popularity. So they brought it indoors. And there was various incarnations. And this one is Gossima. Actually started in 1891. Angelique is right because she sniffs out that it's made out of a cork because she can smell champagne at an impressive distance. But it is a cork that is webbed over. But anyway, but it didn't have really good bounce. So eventually it's replaced by celluloid down the road.
Huh.
Dorian and Angelique, they talk of subterfuge, delicious secrets, and of being who they want to be and not who they are. They kiss and then some people stare. And yeah, there may be a connection with Lyle, but I think this character, I worry for Angelique. I worry that Dorian's going to hurt her.
You worry
about Angelique. Yeah, and I worry this is where you're going to see Dorian go dark.
Yeah. Flavor of the month, a little revenge. I agree. I could see that.
So maybe that's where you're going to get your story payoff is because something's going to happen to Angelique and he's just going to go ballistic, you know, and we're going to see the real Dorian.
No, he's going to be the one that hurts Angelique.
Oh, okay. I stand corrected.
I'm saying, you know, that's my theory.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean by going dark.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, yeah. He hurts her. Mm-hmm. Puts her portrait on the wall.
Hmm. More on that in feedback. Hecate reports her failure to Evelyn. Hecate is convinced that Ethan smelled her. And Evelyn says that they will have to meet him tooth for claw. Evelyn is going to prepare the enchantment tonight. Hecate knows what to bring her, which is hair, we later find out. And she tells Hecate to not disappoint her again, and this is where Hecate hisses at her. Evelyn tells her to be careful and that she overreaches. Hecate says she does not trust Lyle, and Evelyn says, it's only Ives that matters, bring me what I need.
I like this scene because when she hisses at her, she says, caution, daughter, you know, don't, you're overreaching. But I think she would have been disappointed if she didn't react in some way, because it would have shown a lack of ambition on her part. And then she would have been like, well, I don't need a follower that's that docile because you're not going to be able to pull the trigger when the time comes.
She's got spirit, you know.
Spunk. You got spunk.
I still say spunk like it was intended.
That's right. Spunk.
Yes, Lily tries on her dress. She can hardly breathe with the corset, and this may encourage Brona to surface because her breathing reminded me of Brona from last season.
Ooh, that's a good point I didn't even think about.
She feels cumbersome in the corset and the shoes. Dr. Frankenstein is taken with her beauty, and he works on her hem because he's good with stitching. Ha ha. And then they discuss why women wear corsets. She says they seem cruel. And he says women wear corsets so they do not exert themselves. Men keep women corseted in theory and in practice. They are meant to flatter the figure. She responds, to a man's eye, anyway. All we do is for men, isn't it? Keep their houses, their children, flatter them with our pain. She asks him if he wants to wear...
if he wants to wear the corset.
Do you want to wear the corset, motherfucker?
Oh, I already did.
Yeah, I'm wearing it right now.
So she asks him if he wants her to wear the corset, and he says no, he does not want anything to cause her pain. But she then decides to keep the shoes, even though they hurt her feet, because he likes them. So this cues us into knowing that she has feelings for him.
Even though he's a creep.
And that the relationship between male and female is ever so complicated.
Yeah, he's only a creep because she doesn't know who he really is. If he wasn't her creator, if he hadn't done the things that he had already done, their relationship would seem perfectly natural. In fact, it would be viewed as romantic.
He acts creepy consistently, though.
He has no experience, though. I think that's part of it. Go ahead.
He's just a little robot creep. You know what I mean? Very that's the move I expected. You know.
This scene brought up there's a parable. I think it's called a parable. But anyway, that I read a long time ago, and I don't know if it's Arthurian in origin or not. But anyway, the gist of it is there's a knight, and he has a wife, and she looks like an old crone half the time, and then the other half of the time she looks like a fair maiden. And she sits him down and she tells him, she says, look, you can have it one or two ways. I can either be one of these things with you, you know, in our alone time at night, or I can be one of these things in the daytime when you take me out. So basically saying, you could take me out and show me off to the world as this beautiful fair maiden, or I could be this ugly looking old shriveled crone. And then, but whatever I am during the day, I'm going to be the opposite at night. So pick. And he says, basically he just gives it back to her and he says, what do you want to do? What's your take on this? And that was the right answer. And then she becomes the fair maiden the whole time. So it made me think of this because Victor's kind of like giving her that same option and saying, I don't want you to do anything that makes you feel uncomfortable at all unless you want to. And she says, okay, good. I'm going to take off this goddamn corset, but I'm keeping on the shoes that are uncomfortable because you like them. So it's like it's a compromise. And like Em said, it's very symbolic of the complicated relationship between the sexes.
Too bad the monster's going to rip his arms off when he figures out what's happening, though. And that'll push him into the arms of the what's the name of the couple again? I keep forgetting it. The people that own the building.
The Poo-Poo Putneys?
Poo-Poo Putneys.
Yeah.
I don't know why I can't remember that.
It's the Poo-Poo
It could Putneys. Push him into the Poo-Poo Putneys' arms, so then he just stays there as the freak.
Okay. So Malcolm Murray is having difficulty translating in translating the Arabic. Lyle gives Malcolm Murray some glasses to aid him, which helps him discover another part of the narrative. Malcolm Murray tells Lyle about Evelyn, and Lyle says to be careful with that one.
Now, he does play that off really good because he's like, oh, you're courting somebody. Who on earth could it be? And then he's just like, you know her. I met her at the seance you set up or that she set up or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I says, it's Evelyn Poole. And he's like, oh, well, you should be careful with that one. You know, and he played that off really well because you could see the emotions go over his face. He was like worried. And then he goes, oh, well, you know, she's this or that. And I forgot exactly what he said, but.
Well, he compliments in this scene, too, about how great the glasses look on him. And, that, you know, he's being a little slyer than usual. It was smooth on his part.
Now, he's talking about Byzantine relationships.
Dalliances.
Dalliances. Mm-hmm. And he says from Stoke-on-Trent to Budapest, he's kind of left a trail of Byzantine relationships in his wake. And you can look at Malcolm Murray's eyes during this scene, and you can kind of see that there's some sort of concern or doubt about what's being said. He knows that Lyle is participating in some sort of subterfuge. He's not quite sure what or how. So
you think?
I think so, yeah. Because I watched it twice, and I rewound it again on the second time to look at it, and I was pretty sure you could see something. They kind of narrow a little bit, and they shift from side to side. He's trying to figure something out. So
I'll have to try, like, rewatch that part.
Lyle's words give him away in this scene.
Interesting.
That's my
See, favorite. I didn't catch any of that at all. Tomorrow, I'm going to have to take notes, listen to the pod, watch it again, and catch some of these things that I've missed.
Well, I thought that what he said about Evelyn Poole might have continued to reverberate in his mind while he was talking about the dalliances. Like, maybe he quit listening to Lyle, and he was thinking about that.
Could have been.
Yeah, that could just as easily be. Either way, he's thinking about her in a not quite courtly manner at this point. He's kind of considering the facts as they exist to him, you know, as they are, like facts on the ground, as they say, rather than what he'd like them to be.
So next up, Ethan tells Ives about Hecate. Ives figures out that Hecate was not hired by Ethan's father, but that she is a witch. Ives describes the witches as chameleons. He leaves to go get some coffee. Malcolm Murray calls Ives over to look at their current progress on the puzzle's narrative. Ethan walks the house with the coffee tray and senses one of the witches hiding in the walls, but he does not see her, so he walks on. And also I should point out that Ethan has revealed to Ives that his father is looking for him.
This is significant.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Not for this episode yet, but or obviously.
Maybe for later.
It'll come into play later.
He's slowly telling her who he is. Because he started in episode one in the carriage, and so he's just given her another bit of information just now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe
the tray of food that he was carrying distorted his smell, so he didn't smell the witch standing next to him.
Maybe.
Probably not.
I didn't think of that, but that could be a point, or maybe it was a kind of like sixth sense kind of thing to where he could feel the presence rather than do it with any of the regular five senses.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure they took precautions to make sure they don't, you know, fart or anything, stink up the place.
Yeah.
Once he embraces who he is, he's going to be able to pinpoint those smells better or what
It'll
he's
be
sensing
awesome.
better. Yeah,
Yeah, when he finally gains control of it, it'll be fucking so badass.
So he helps Senbene with the dishes, and he tries to find out more about Senbene with no luck. Senbene calls Ives a lioness, and he is. So we learn that Senbene's not worried about Ives, but he is worried about Malcolm Murray. I guess he does find out that he was a hunter in Africa, but that's all.
Well, he says, can I ask you a question? And he was like, can I stop you? You know, and then he asks him, he says, were you a hunter? So he guesses that. Mm-hmm. And then he says, well, partly. And he's like, well, what's the other part? And he's not forthcoming at all about that. And
maybe he's a witch doctor.
I have a theory. I think he was a contestant on Hell's Kitchen and with his buttercream tort. And Gordon Ramsay, he doesn't want to talk about it because Gordon Ramsay had that moment with him when he didn't have a good service. And he said, Senbene, take off your jacket and leave Hell's Kitchen.
Oh, poor Senbene.
That's why he doesn't want to talk about it, but he still makes a damn fine buttercream tort.
That would be pretty funny fucking spoof.
But we're getting a little bit of that character development that we're really hungering for with him, you know, because he's so intriguing. It's like, what the hell is up with his face, you know, the scars on him? Where is he from? What's the nature of the relationship between him and Malcolm Murray? I mean, there's so many things to be answered, and they're just doling it out at such a snail's pace. I still love it, but I mean, I wish we could get just a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Just like you're saying about Dorian, Paul, I want to get a little
bit
more about Senbene. Maybe
they know how to tease you for sure.
Yeah, I don't want a Senbene ping pong scene. I don't know if that would be in the nature of the show.
It would be hilarious.
So Malcolm Murray and Lyle share their constructed sentence with Ives, and then Malcolm Murray proposes that this may be a prophecy specifically about Ives' future. This upsets her, understandably. She cannot accept that she is the object of an eternal satanic quest. She apologizes and then heads up to bed. On her way past the kitchen, a witch hides in the wall. She tells Ethan and Senbene goodnight. They offer her buttercream tort. She says she will have some for breakfast.
Yeah.
Does she always eat that for breakfast? Or does she always eat dessert for breakfast?
Always. Always.
I think Amazing. That's a commentary on the kind of person she is. I don't think he's being literal. I don't think she wakes up and has cheesecake.
She does what she wants.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Exactly. She does what she wants. She's that kind of person. Now, before we go on, the script, what they find on the script for the little puzzles and stuff like that they're interpreting or translating, rather, is they're talking about God pulling them, the fallen angels, by their wings and then throwing them, casting them down into hell. That's such a badass visual. Like,
yes, it's going to be pretty fucking awesome. You think we'll get a scene where they actually show us like an angel or a fallen angel, you know?
Maybe it'll be an anime.
Yeah, like Kill Bill style.
Could be. I would still watch it.
They're going to have Andy Samberg as God, and he's going to be, I took him and threw him
on the ground.
I'm an adult.
So in Ives' room, she is wary, but she continues to ready herself for bed. She brushes her hair as the others downstairs do their thing, buttercream tort and deciphering the puzzle, to be exact. Soon enough, Ives is attacked, as well as the others, when the three witches reveal themselves. Ethan needs to calibrate his witch sensor because he gets pushed from behind, shoved into the wall, which is pretty funny. The one in Ives' bedroom achieves her goal, which is obtaining some of her hair. And then Lyle, even though he is under Evelyn Poole's boot, still fights back with the cross. And I wonder if this will come back on him next episode, or maybe a little bit later down the road. Hecate is, she's one of those bitches that have to have the last word, because she was like, oh, what did she say about sensible shoes?
Do I have sensible shoes now, Mr. Chandler?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I don't think Lyle was, I don't think anything's going to come back on Lyle because of that. Maybe it will from one of the other sisters, but I don't think it will from Evelyn Poole, because I think she wanted him to do that to kind of convince everybody that he was part and parcel of the Dreadfuls. You know what I mean? So when he gets pushed down, it looks realistic. You know, he was trying to help in his own small way.
Yeah. And he's going to be like, oh, I knew it wasn't going to be effective or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, why it wasn't effective, I don't know. I mean, I guess these are just
now,
super-powered witches or something like
that.
What
if he was already working with them and knew they were there? Like, maybe they did have wards up, but somehow him being there, maybe he was the one who let them in the first place.
If that's the case, it better be addressed in the first, like, 2 minutes of the
next
episode.
Yeah, they would have to reveal that pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then the suspicion would turn to him, who's the only person who didn't help kill a bunch of vampires last year, or a week ago, rather? You know, it's you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they might not figure it out. They might just have Evelyn Poole tell us. Maybe it's a scene with him going, I got the hair, did your job well, and he's probably feeling like shit, shaking in his boots. I mean, that could explain the whole why the wards didn't work,
True, yeah. I did like Senbenny tackling one of the witches, though.
Oh, man, full force, too.
Yeah,
it was awesome.
She just kind of torpedoed across the floor, she was like, ugh.
Yeah, I mean, they really did catch the Dreadfuls, with their pants down,
I mean,
no one was ready. There was no guns nearby. There was nothing. I guarantee you there might be some guns spread out around the house now.
That's a power I don't hear much about for witches, being able to do that. How about you guys?
Being able to
come into the walls like that? And
yeah, I've never heard anything.
Were they in the walls, or were they just chameleoned out to where they were couldn't see them, the wallpaper? They looked to me like they were just chameleon.
Well, the very first time you see one of them, I think right after Ethan walks by with the tray of food, if I'm not mistaken, one of them kind of
comes
out a little bit and then comes back in. So they're kind of pushing themselves through the wall.
Well, when the one attacked Ives in her room, it came out of the wall.
Yeah. Yeah, because she comes all the way and you can see her eyes and stuff like that. And then here's one thing I'm wondering about. Evelyn Poole says, we're going to have to fight them.
Tooth for claw.
Tooth for claw. So at some point, this is foreshadowing. It didn't happen in this episode, and I kind of wish it did, but I understand they have to get knocked around a little bit before you get the good revenge scene. But I'm ready for Ethan to just go full werewolf bar mitzvah
and kill
one of these women. That's going to happen, because one of them's disposable. Mm-hmm. It won't be Hecate. It'll be,
one of the other two.
Yeah, one of the other two.
And then he'll finally reveal himself to everybody, and everybody's just going to stand there and be like,
yeah, they'll all look at each other like at the end when they were looking at each other after they ran through the broken door, it'll be that kind of thing.
Will St. Ives be the one to talk them off the ledge, don't hurt anybody, Ethan. You're a good person. Come back.
Yeah, or she could go over and start petting his hair.
Gives him a doggy treat.
Jerky. Huh?
Don't make me rub your nose in it.
Who's a good boy?
Or she gives him the Rollo and the Merry Moon. No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Sit. Or he kills everybody at the end of the show.
Yeah. Next episode. Or it could be like the 80s TV reference. Sit, Ethan, sit. Good dog.
Woof, woof. Woof.
I don't know, man. It's anything's fair game at this point. But the preview for the next episode showed some pretty cool stuff going on. So
Damn it. I didn't get to see the previews.
It's just a little mini 10-second thing.
Feedback time.
Feedback, feedback, feedback. You'll pay for the whole seat, but you'll only need the edge. All right, here we go. Werewolves and witches. Hey guys, Katie Fireworks here. I have some speculations to offer for discussion. I'm curious whether Vanessa has been feigning ignorance or has repressed memories about her witchy past. Most recently, we know she had a flair for the Verbis Diablo as the cutwife tutored her, but she claimed to not know what she said to the witch who attacked her in the carriage, episode 1. We also witnessed the cutwife explaining deadly nightshade to her. In season 1, when she encounters Belladonna in the greenhouse with Dorian Gray, she is oblivious. Is she trying to hide her true knowledge of dark things, or has she somehow repressed the teachings of the cutwife? Discuss.
She's hiding it. She's hiding it.
Agreed.
She doesn't want to let all the cats out of the bag, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. I think she has this knowledge, and she is keeping it to herself because she didn't want to tell anybody about the cutwife. I mean, she has a secret past, just like Ethan has a secret past, Eminem, Senbenny, Victor, everybody.
So she's admitting to it now, right?
Yeah.
So initially she was not.
Because now past is coming back to haunt her, so she
has to. Yeah, and she's around people she knows she can trust. Think about how the cutwife was treated when people wanted to get rid of her. They could just call her out as a witch. So you don't want to publicly put all that shit out there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You want to only tell the people that you're close to that you know how to speak the devil's language, know how to poison somebody. You know what I mean? You don't want to just put everything out in the open. So it's genius that she's going to wait because, I mean, at the beginning of even season 1, you're like, oh, this frail woman is possessed. And then as the seasons go, you're like, she is a bona fide badass. You know? So it's smart.
It's a good point that you're bringing up because, I mean, in 2015, if you say you're a witch, people could take you seriously. They might think you're a jackass, but you're going to be the center of conversation. It's mm-hmm. going to be something to talk about. 1890s, maybe not so much, you know, that you might not want to put that out there. So regarding Ethan, whom I love, werewolves are my fave. With his knowledge of Latin and affinity for Catholic idols, I think he may have been in seminary before he was turned. The original Wolfman movie in Hollywood is where the idea of the bite causing the transformation was born. Actual werewolves throughout history were made in three ways. One, heredity. Two, curse by a witch. Three, personal choice, performing a spell or completing some feat that would grant one the power to turn. I think Ethan was cursed while studying to join the priesthood. Interesting. He seems such a devoted and compassionate individual, he could easily be a priest. Maybe the story he told about the Indian children being taken away was an allegory about God turning his back on Ethan when he was cursed. Anyway, I'm definitely looking forward to finding out more about Ethan.
I think Fireworks should be our resident werewolf scholar.
Right? That was pretty on point. I mean, I never even thought about him being a priest. You know, I mean, a little bit in last season, but... putting it that way is pretty fantastic, you know, it kind of works.
I mean, you just don't commonly know how to, you know, even the most rudimentary steps to exercise a demon. Most people don't know that. Go ask your neighbor. Mm-hmm. They're going to be like, I'm calling the cops. You know, that's what they're going to say. But they're not going to know, you know, and he knew a lot of these things. And I mean, where did he get it from? So,
yeah, I like the hereditary angle, too. And maybe that's why he joins the seminary to try and... run from that. I don't know. I mean, the hereditary thing definitely after this episode could buy you a possibility.
Which I've brought up the hereditary thing, mm-hmm. but I was ridiculed.
What the fuck?
Because I used, not by you, by Steve, because I used Teen Wolf as my justification for it being hereditary.
I loved it when his dad wolfed out. I don't know why. When I was a kid, I was like, sweet.
I just don't buy hereditary as a plausible thing. Same thing with vampirism. I just don't see it because then you have family reunions and then you have like all of these werewolves gathered all together. It would become
you
obvious.
You play Who Let the Dogs Out? Everybody wolfs out, you know? I had to. I've been waiting. Yeah.
I've been holding this one in since last year.
Yes. That's been hard.
Well, that's probably why he wants him back. You know, it's...
Look, I don't know. I'm just saying that hereditary seems to me to be the least plausible for lycanthropy.
He probably didn't start to turn until he came of a certain age. His dad didn't bother to tell him until around that time, and now he's pissed at his dad, and he's left, and so there you go.
Well, we know we have a bit of a tell with this guy that's in the hospital, right? If it's really by bite or by claw or whatever, well, no, because eventually this season, knock on wood, this guy will wolf out or he won't wolf out. You know what I mean? So we have maybe a clue coming throughout this season.
If he starts to crave human flesh, he's a Wendigo.
Mm. Or a Winnebago. Either one. So she goes on to say, I was over the moon. Very funny. When I found out that the creators of my favorite Vikings podcast were also covering Penny Dreadful. Hell yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've always had a love for the horror, and I have a cast iron gut, so I'm not a bit squeamish. I am an ER/ICU veterinarian nurse, so I see a lot of crazy stuff.
She sees a lot of werewolves. Man.
Thanks for continually putting out great casts. Y'all make my daily commute the highlight of my day. Faithful listening, Fireworks. Sweet.
Awesome. Thank you.
Fireworks, you are now our resident werewolf expert and our animal expert. So if we have questions, we're going to do this via Twitter somehow, but we're going to ask you about it if we need to understand the feasibility of something that has to do with animals. So it doesn't matter if you want to or not, you're stuck with that task. Thank you for the kind words and thank you for writing in. We really appreciate
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's just a really nice thing to say, and it's always good to have somebody like that on our side. It's awesome.
I really like that I was over the moon when I found out, because it's like, is she talking about lycanthropy? Or is she talking about Mary Moon? You know, you just don't know.
Awesome. Thanks, Fireworks.
Thank you. Thank you
but
very much.
I just have to confess, I don't like ferrets, and I hope you can forgive me for that, because you probably like ferrets.
Most people don't like ferrets. I think that's a common thing.
Oh. I think I would like ferrets if they bathed.
Exactly.
You know,
see?
Teach them how to bathe. It would be totally fine. I like the animal. I just don't like the pee.
There's a caveat there. I would like ferrets.
A lot of caveats.
No one
says
that about
for baths.
No one says that about cats or dogs or even monkeys. They say it about ferrets, though. They're like, I would like ferrets if. Anyway, our second piece of feedback, and Emma's had me do these in order of
reception.
How they appeared
Ooh,
in the Gmail.
Nice, so we know who's on fire and who's a little slower to the get-go.
This is the way she set
That's
up.
Not why I did it.
This is the way that M set this up. So this is how I'm reading.
Who
this.
Is more devoted is what this book comes down to.
This one is from Anissa S, a.k.a. the Impoverished Scholar. And she sent us, it's a short feedback, but she has a cool little picture that she has. And I don't know if it's a still from the show. It doesn't.
I think it's from a preview for the entire series.
Okay. That makes more sense because he's not in the bed. Here, I'll hold it up. Can you see it?
Oh, up a little higher.
Just a little
okay.
higher.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Nice.
All right. So it's Mr. Roper. And it says, I know who the Cotton Masked Man is. I am listening to your podcast right now on season 2, episode 3, and you guys are talking about the Cotton Masked Man. I just had an epiphany. The Cotton Masked Man is this guy, and she sends the picture. This is a photo from the trailer for season 2. Then I went onto the Penny Dreadful Wikia to try to find the names of the two bounty hunters that were stalking Ethan. I wanted to find the actor's photos to compare to this picture. The Wikia said that Warren Roper is the mutilated man lying on the hospital bed. That was the white guy bounty hunter. At first, I thought that was a spoiler. Then I went back and watched the scene with him in the hospital bed with the subtitles on, and the cop says, get better, Mr. Roper. The Cotton Masked Man is Warren Roper, the bounty hunter. Mm. So this obviously was sent in before, you know, this episode came out. So, but she was on the ball.
Yes.
She's on point.
Yeah, you aren't kidding. It's the man in the leather mask.
Thanks, Anissa.
Yeah, thank you very much for the feedback.
Or maybe if, by the way, his masks look, he's the Phantom of the Opera brought to life.
Huh? Oh.
It does. Dun, hiding half the face. Yeah. Dun, dun, dun,
dun, dun. He's right. Going to wolf out. They're going to take that off and he's going to be totally healed underneath. Like, huh? What happened?
Yeah. See, what they're going to try to set up a fight between Mr. Roper and Ethan. And then they're gonna kind of fight, but then they're gonna stop in the middle and start attacking the witches. Because they're gonna be like, werewolves don't fight each other; they fight witches, dummy.
They hug.
Yeah, werewolves don't shake hands.
I wish they had hug. Named him something else other than Mr. Roper. It kind of just always
Three's
distracts
company.
Me. Yeah, it really does distract me a little bit.
All right, our third piece of feedback is called "The Nightcomers" from Ronald Smith. He says, "Hey guys, really love your podcast. I was a big fan of your Vikings coverage, and I'm glad to see you're doing another season of Penny Dreadful. Thank you. Thank you very much for listening."
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure this is too late for the feedback on Nightcomers, but wanted to write anyway. I agree with M that this was the best episode ever. Ah, very nice. It was just fantastic. The pacing, the dialogue, the unrecognizable Patti LuPone, and her great performance. Just stunning. Every episode is a visual palette for the senses. I really love John Logan's writing. I don't know why it took me so long to Google him, but I found that he has a very impressive resume with features like Gladiator, Any Given Sunday, the invention of Hugo Cabret, and others, to name a few. Anyway, the only small quibble I had with the episode was the final act. I think it would have been more powerful to let the viewer imagine the horrible fate the cutwife would suffer at the hands of the locals.
I agree.
While it was well mm-hmm. done, showing her murder was a little too typical Hollywood to me. Perhaps it would have been more powerful to have left the camera on Vanessa's face as the cutwife burned. Yeah, I mean, they were cutting, no pun intended, but they were cutting back and forth between Vanessa's face and what was actually happening to her.
Maybe we could have seen it in her eye.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, like a shadow of it mm-hmm. or like seeing the flames or something.
See, I liked it. I thought it was genius just by – to be a little too Hollywood, they would have had the big fire pit and all the big logs and set her on fire, and she would have been, like, cursing everybody. That they had her chained, and then they threw the pitch on her and then lit her on fire that way. It showed how strong she was and the simple fact that she didn't scream or anything. Mm-hmm. And then the imagery of her eyes before they lit her on fire with the tar and then during. I mean, I thought it was excellent. I thought it was excellent. I disagree with that.
I could see both ways. I liked it how it was. I was very satisfied with it. But, I mean, it could have possibly been more powerful just to have her facial expressions conveying what's done because
– emotionally, yeah,
emotionally,
for the viewer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Eva Green is such a great actress that she can – you know, she's one of those actresses that can convey so much with just her face. But Ronald Smith goes on to say, kind of like Theon and Sansa – oh, sorry. Don't get me started on that. Amen. I totally agree with you. Anyway, love the podcast. Keep up the good work. Thank you very much. We appreciate you listening.
Yeah, absolutely.
He says, oh, one other thing. As soon as I heard the name Hecate, one of Evelyn Poole's acolytes, I knew it sounded familiar. I didn't hear you mention its origins, though. She is a Greek goddess. From Wikipedia, she was variously associated with crossroads, entranceways, dogs, light, the moon, magic, witchcraft, knowledge of herbs and poisonous plants, ghosts, necromancy, and sorcery. That covers everything, though. Obviously, there's much more to read about her. To the gates, Ron.
Nice.
Ron is an author.
Oh, yeah. Let's give a shout out to Ron. Let's give a little plug to Ron right here.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
Ron L. Smith is actually an author. He has a published book out, and he takes time out of his busy life to listen to our podcast, so we're going to do this for him. He is the author of Hoodoo that is published by Clarion, Houghton, Milf, and Harcourt, and it was done in the fall of 2015.
Okay, and he's got a website, and it's strangeblackflowers.com, and you can go read the reviews of his book, which are pretty impressive.
Here's one review from Gary D. Schmidt, who is a National Book Award finalist. What a splendid novel. Reader, be prepared to have your foundations shaken. This is a world that is deeper, more wondrous, more spiritually charged than you may have ever imagined. So
nice.
Check out Ron's stuff. Awesome. Thanks a lot for
writing
this.
I know we are.
Yeah, it actually sounds very interesting. I read the description of the book, and I like
it. Awesome. I know I'm going to check it out.
Strangeblackflowers.com.
So now the next piece of feedback is actually from Bib Fortuna.
And oh, Bib.
She has two pieces of feedback. The first page is actually some tiny emails, and that we're going to put them together and read them all at once. So she says, rewatching season 2, episode 1, and realizing Ives' flashbacks in the snow are from episode 3. Didn't put that together. I can't find the article, but I read that the writer/creator is a big fan of the actress Helen McCrory, who obviously plays Evelyn Poole, and created the role for her. I would think he also knew where it was headed from the get-go. Therefore, I think the seance persona was a put-on. She's playing the long game, particularly since she's been around since Cromwell. Agreed.
Yes, agreed. And I read the same thing on Reddit. Somebody else had wrote that on Reddit, and apparently you can find that information on IMDb. There's a quote on there from John Logan, but I didn't go and verify it.
So it says, I find it interesting that there hasn't been a conversation about what the title of the book means. Do those of you who haven't read it have theories? Just poking the bear.
So she's asking, this is about Dorian Gray, picture of Dorian Gray. She had originally, there was another email she had asked if she got the impression that none of us have read the picture of Dorian Gray. And I wrote her back and said that I have read it and that Steve is aware of the story.
I'm aware of it. I kind of skimmed through, kind of took bits and pieces.
And but we haven't talked a lot about it because I'm going to just worry about it because I don't know if all listeners have read it and may not want to know. They may consider it spoiler. And especially after what happened with Vikings on our last.
Exactly.
I don't, if anybody wants to write in theories about any of the books, they're welcome to. Just please put the headings possible spoilers and we'll have a separate section. And Paul, you're welcome to opt out of it if you want or be a part of it.
Yeah,
it's up to you.
Well, I read some of it, so I mean I know what happens. It's just I don't want to it's the same thing. I don't want to spoil it for anybody. I did it. Right. I read parts of it the first season because I wasn't expecting to actually do the podcast. So I was like, well, I was kind of like not in love with the show right away. Last season was a little rough for me, so I was like, well, I'm gonna go ahead and just do a little digging. So I mean that's the reason why. If I had been fully in love with the show from the very beginning, I would have tried to avoid it. So.
The theory I have about Angelique is based on my knowledge of the book, but I try not to go too far with it. So I do use it to inform my theories, but I try not to reveal too much at the same time. But again, Bib, if you have something you want to say or something you want to hear us talk about, write it in and we'll discuss it. We'll just have a spoiler section.
So. All right, cool. She goes on to say, yes, Paul, S&M has been around since, well, look up the novel Venus and Furs, 1870's very own 50 Shades of Grey. I'm sure Victorians were titillated and inspired. And if we're talking Evelyn Poole, that old witch probably hung out with the Marquis de Sade in the 18th century. Oh, that's a good point. Learned a few.
I knew it was around back then. I mean, Jesus Christ. People are freaks. People are freaks. It's probably been around even longer than that. I mean, come on. I just think that it's hot for the times. That's all. I mean, they're going to put it in our face every chance they get.
Paul's reading Venus and Furs tonight.
Oh, it's there.
It's downloaded on the Kindle as we speak.
It's already there.
I'm going to comment on Season 2, Episode 3 podcast, which just gets weird, meta, whatever. Steve, I had an enthusiastic conversation last night about that very thing. We have these wonderful, well-crafted stories because TV has morphed into a better vehicle. Sure, we still have crap out there, but there is so much more. There's so much at this point in time that I'm interested in and attracted to. Speaking of which, how is Outlander going for you? Just kidding. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
yeah. We're still committed to watching at least an episode.
I don't have time because now I have to read books about S&M. So sorry.
Yeah. Bib, I will take you to Jabba now. Also has she has her stream of conscious style feedback that she would do for the Vikings sometimes, and she did this for this episode. So
I'm glad she's with us.
Yeah, we're really glad she's with us because this shit is funny. So just watching so far makes me nervous. I'm struggling with Ferdy and his duplicity. She's talking about Ferdinand, of course. But that beard is amazing, and he's having the vapors. Quick, get the smelling salts. How is Frankenstein a non-believer in magic? Dude, you make people.
That's what I say. I totally
Science
agree.
Bitches. With
yeah, exactly. Yep. There you go. The Memoirs of the Devil. God was so mean today. I hate him. I'm going to run away. So was Lucifer a petulant 13-year-old? Sembeni's lion comparison with the witches they hunt at night was a nice Africa tie-in, as in calling Ives a lioness later in the episode. Yeah, I meant to bring that up, but he's saying that, you know, these witches are like lions, and Ives is a lioness, so they're equally matched, I think is what's being said.
But... Not so fast. Wait till we get to Duncan Powers.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Next up, she says, shit, I thought we were at the wax museum, but it's dead babies, dead folks. Why would they take a dead baby? Sir, you have no imagination. Puppets. Evil puppets. I like the twist on Frankenstein's story with the blind girl. Forget Billy Lilly. The blind girl gets you.
Billy Lilly.
Yeah. Billy Piper just can't help falling in love with doctors.
Aww.
I'm just glad she's blonde. I'm just
It all comes back to this, yeah. But, all right. Hold up. The survivor is Leatherface, who spouted the werewolf who spouted the werewolf theory about the survivor? I fully support this.
That'd be Paul.
That would be you. Yep. Credit to Paul on this one. Ives' expression outside the dress shop needs to be a gif. Victor, that cousin story is not going to hold water. And watch out for those mannequins. My non-husband and I work at Ives. Victor is distracted by the tassels on the curtains like a kitty cat. I've never seen you wear white. It's not my color. Ives, goth before goth.
Yeah,
because she was like, I'm not a virgin like you, Victor. Why don't you put the white dress on?
I'm virgin. I've got some. Watch out for the terrifying underwear, Doc. I hate planes, Doc. Flirting with a werewolf. Ethan will take the geography for 500, Alex. Nice bust on Northwestern not being in Indiana, thank you. Sensible shoe witch is shut down. Puppet seance? Jeez, enough with the damn puppets. Asking Dorian Gray how old he is? Adorable. And now, a wild night of ping pong. Looks more like tonsil hockey to me.
What hockey?
Tonsil hockey.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, back at Endora's, he smelled me. Damn right Ethan Wolf did. Oh crap, does she need another baby? Endora is the Wicked Witch. She wants Dorothy, but go ahead and destroy the Scarecrow, the Tin Man, and the Cowardly Lion. All she needs is some flying monkeys. I would like some lady to exert herself on Victor. That guy needs it hot and dirty and now. He's getting sadder by the minute. But he is good with stitching. Corseted in theory and in practice. I feel some Brona seeping through. Ooh. Bond needs some readers. Something damn manly, please. Courting a witch, proceed with caution. Thanks for the tip, Ferdy. By the way, I fear for your life, little man. What in the Sam hell is in the wallpaper? Jesus H. Christ, those bitches are in the wallpaper. Tort cutting tension followed by witch attack. Talk demon to me. You better run, ladies. Security at Bond Manor needs some work. The end. Best line of the evening. Does she always eat dessert for breakfast? Always. Theory. The Billy Lilly photos at Dorian's are going to cause big trouble.
Oh, yeah.
Big trouble. Later, Bib Fortuna. Jesus Christ, that shit's hilarious. It's like this stream of conscious comedy take on the whole episode in 2 minutes.
Fantastic.
That would be great if those photos surfaced up, because if he had a long game for Evelyn Poole, he had a long game also for Dorian and mm-hmm. his involvement in the photos and various things like that.
So it just goes to show.
It's a slow boil.
Just goes to show that people's, you know, love lives and sex lives were getting fucked up well before email and Facebook. Our next piece of feedback is entitled Buttercream Dream by we're going to call her the Buttercream Dream. That's what she wants to be called. She's also known as Buttercream Dream.
Hi, Buttercream Dream.
She's a Lorraine DC at iTunes, but she's also known as Buttercream Dream. So that's what we're going to call her. Anyway,
that's why she left us some reviews.
BCD.
Thank you.
Thank you for the reviews and thank you for
absolutely.
All right, so here we go. Hi, love the podcast and thank you for your thoughtful and entertaining approach. Well, I'm glad it's either, honestly, you know, but great. Awesome. I liked this episode a lot and it was nice to see Vanessa's light side and smile. Really like the domestic side of Sebene, especially his buttercream torte. I was wondering if he baked it himself or purchased it at the bakery. His slicing skills are superb.
I'm going to go with purchasing because I tried to look up a buttercream torte recipe from Victorian times. There was other cakes, but man, that's some serious business to bake back then.
Hey, he's a man of many talents. I think he made it.
On top of everything else he's doing.
Yeah, he's a badass and he doesn't sleep. What else is he going to do? Just sit at the top of the stairs? No, he's going to prepare his ingredients for a buttercream torte.
Okay.
All right.
I think I agree with Paul on this because he's
bro code.
It adds to the mystery.
Guys can't agree with each other without it being a bro code thing. I don't even know what this bro code is. I know Jack Donaghy says that here at TGS we have a strict bros before hoes policy when he's talking to Lewis
Lemon.
That's
a version of bro code.
Okay, well, I don't work at TGS, and Jack Donaghy's not my boss, although I wish he was. Sensible shoes, haha, Ethan. Victorian ping pong. Dorian is such a trendsetter. Smiley face. Question, how old is Evelyn Poole? The Cutwife didn't look terribly old to me, but it seems she had been around since Cromwell's time. Just curious if Evelyn was really old, since she traded her soul for beauty and anti-aging treatments. Maybe that's why her doll collection is so extensive. Many years of voodooing. Keep up the great work, and thanks again.
Well, I would think she's the same age as the Cutwife, because it sounded like they had gone through the training together, and then they were like, when it's time to either go super demonic or not, they split, and that's why when they had first seen each other after a while, they were like, damn, you look the same. And Evelyn Poole's like, well, you look like an old hag.
Yeah.
So I would think close to the same age, a few hundred years each.
Because she turned toward the dark side mm-hmm. when she knew her. So she didn't start killing virgins and all that stuff till later. So I think you're right.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah.
I think because that's the impression I got from the Cutwife.
Yeah. Because she was still a good guy. They were, and the Cutwife already made out.
Yeah. Made out.
Thank you for the letter, Buttercream Dream.
Yeah.
It's kind of hot.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Buttercream Dream.
Buttercream Dream.
Buttercream Dream.
Buttercream Dream.
Princess Buttercream.
Yeah, there we go. There's the name. I'm going to say it like that.
That's your nickname.
Princess Buttercream.
All right. And now we're up to our final piece of feedback for the night, and it is from Dunkin' Donuts.
Who is this Dunkin' Donuts?
You might remember her from such shows as Vikings on the History Channel.
Oh, yeah, that's right. She won our last contest. Duh. Now I remember.
She says, good evening, humans. Wow, am I right? This season is getting so good. I appreciate the beauty of the episode with all of its textures. The silk robe, the curly hair, the moth, the dead bird, the lingerie, the cake and coffee and carnival lights and wax molds. Compared to last week's feast of acting in the dusty moor, this was dessert. I wanted to touch everything. See, that's what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Dunkin' Donuts hits it on the head. It's such a contrast from having it be like inside of this like dour house in the moors to like a little bit of everything and everybody that makes the mm-hmm. show good. The nighttime symbols were rich. Moths, lions, owl wings. I wonder if even the dead bird was a nightingale. It was interesting that Sembeni labeled Vanessa a lioness, but the witch as lions. In the animal world, of course, lionesses are the main hunters, and lions follow after. Ooh, feasting on the kill. I did not know that. So the...
You need...
Huh.
See, those women took over the world in that world.
Yeah.
Those lions are not wearing corsets.
So the lion, the Lion King's a bunch of bullshit then. That's what I'm getting at.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Let's not go too far.
Kuna Matata and all that. All right. So in his estimation, Vanessa has the greater power. Okay. Yeah, I see what you're saying now. I agree with that. I mean, I think Vanessa's more badass than these witches too. I totally.
Well, yeah.
See
well,
that, they she know just, it. That's why they're trying to get her.
She just hasn't been unleashed yet.
She doesn't have to run around naked to use her powers. I mean, how ridiculous is that?
It's pretty limiting, actually. You know,
I mean, it's pretty cool. You can go invisible into a wall, but they're not as threatening standing there with their just you know.
Yeah, the stuff.
It yeah. would be distracting. They would be like threatening me, and I would be looking at their. Girl parts, you know.
The girl
like, parts. Is that your?
Yeah.
Huh. It would ruin the moment for them. They would just kill me. Like, ah, you idiot.
It's like a trade-off, though. Like, what if somebody said you could have all the powers of Magneto or Wolverine, but to use it, you have to be nude.
I couldn't do it. I don't think I could do it.
See,
I would be a villain because it would be like, really? You got to do that naked? Can't wear a robe, loincloth.
Yeah. Something, please. It also, she goes on to say, it also brings to mind Malcolm's chilling tale in a previous episode when the wind changes and the hunter becomes the hunted. Malcolm looked very shaken when Sir Lyle cautioned him about Evelyn Poole. He was shaken, but not stirred.
Does she say that?
No, I added that. I'm sorry. I'm hoping you're right that he's somehow charmed against witches. I think I'm right. I don't know that I'm right. I hope I'm right, but... He's got something up his sleeve. He's not going to be taken for a dupe that easily.
I hope not. I've got a little more respect for him, you know?
You don't traverse the continent of Africa with Simbene and come back and just get duped by Evelyn Poole and her bloodbath.
You say just Evelyn Poole. She is a pretty badass witch. I mean, her house alone should be in a metal video. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
It's pretty awesome.
Okay, yeah. Well,
because the African voodoo dolls was mentioned, I'm choosing to believe that there is something up their sleeves.
So you're doing like Vanessa. You're choosing to
yes.
believe.
Mm-hmm.
All right. She goes on to say, I'm really enjoying the steady consistency of Ethan's character. He seems to know what each person needs to trust him. And while I'm eager to hear Simbeni's story, I'm glad it wasn't dumped in our laps. Their companionship was lovely. Three episodes ago, Simbeni was all ruffled about Ethan carrying his own suitcase, and now they're buds. Aww. Ethan's scenting ability was revealed subtly. He didn't have to go snorting around, but when you look back at Hecate sobbing in his arms, he's clearly drawing back like he just hugged a snake. The hallway scene of him sniffing and her camouflage was so perfect. Apparently being Lupus Dei does not make him physically stronger than witches, but the fight choreography was well done. Hecate literally slid down the hallway on her arms like she was synchronized swimming. Also, is it me or did the upstairs one run out of the wrong side of the bedroom door?
She hit the closet first. Oh, shit.
Wrong. Well, it looks like she runs behind the door instead of out the door.
Well, she can go through walls. Why? I mean,
that's and Steve brought that up, and I was like, oh yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. That's what yeah. I'm thinking. But
she used the door maybe as another barrier.
Yeah.
Where did she pull the hair from her head?
Yeah.
Yeah. Not sure where else she would have gotten a lock that length. Well, yeah,
hey, it was the 1800s. I mean, come on.
They just grew them longer back then, kids.
I mean, not the witches. It's pretty hair-free.
She says, I also love the cut scenes between Vanessa brushing and the men preparing dessert, back and forth, until the tension was too much. Gah, amazing. Agreed. We didn't really comment on that scene, but it was pretty cool because she's just brushing her hair and they're doing their thing. And you know something fucked up is going to happen. You just don't know when that other shoe's going to drop, that other uncomfortable shoe.
Well, you know because there's witches in the walls.
Yeah, that there's a little bit of a giveaway.
Yeah.
It sounds like a bad horror movie, witches in the walls.
In a town where witches live in walls. Em, I'm seeing what you mean about Dorian going dark in this relationship with Angelique. He looked very annoyed after losing, and he seemed to have more of an edge in this episode. Also, I'm interested in the Wendigo idea regarding Roper. He has tomahawk injuries. This seems like maybe another callback to the idea that they could have both been at Custer's last stand. I'm standing by it until it's proven otherwise.
Ah, cool.
Could be. It's kind of racist that he's like tomahawk injuries. Come on. Come on. Just awful. Just because there's one Native American in the room, you're just going to blame it on a tomahawk.
Yeah. The guy's obviously shot, and he's like, it looks like tomahawk did that. In contrast, the dress shopping scene was hilarious. Victor, the cokehead, is such a hot mess, and Vanessa teased him so hard I was giggling.
Cokehead.
But Shade to Brona, yeah. He's
well,
up
he
all
did
night.
Do drugs last episode, and we haven't seen him do that again.
Last season?
I mean, last season.
Yeah, he did. He did do some
What
coke.
Drugs was he doing?
He was offering people up. Coke, wasn't he? No, he
what?
Was shooting up. That's
he was
right.
shooting up.
Yeah.
I totally don't remember that.
It was during the, when Ethan helped
It was
Ives
during the
with
exorcism.
Possession. Yeah, the exorcism scene.
Huh, son
episode.
Of a bitch. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
That's why he's always got red under his eyes.
He had a don't judge me moment going on.
I thought that was just from crying.
Yeah. He says, shades of Brona are starting to leak through on Lily now, and that cannot be good. Caliban's story is just so, so doomed. Obviously, Putney has plans to trap him in the basement or something horrible. It's almost torturous seeing him open up and consider hope. Well, I mean, yeah, I see something like that coming down the pike. Obviously, the poo-poos have something in store for this guy, and whatever it is, it's not going to be good. But I actually have a theory that... what's going to happen is they're going to try to trap him down there with a bunch of freaks, I guess, for lack of a better term, you know, disfigured people that they're going to use as these unwilling participants in their displays. And I think Caliban's going to become their leader, and he's going to break him out, and then he's going to have a small army to go against Evil and Pools.
Love it.
Yeah, just throwing it out there. I know it's getting
cool
way
idea.
Ahead of myself, but...
Is one of them going to have this, like, mammoth arm?
Yes, one big, gnarly arm.
Big hammering arm.
The one little one.
There's in the
he jabs people in the eyes with the little one.
There's going to be Master Blaster.
Yes. Ooh, he could get his own little Master Blaster.
Oh, yeah, that would be awesome. Who rules Putney's? Master Blaster. Well, there's in the X-Men series of comics in one run, there's the Morlocks, and it's this group of severely mutated mutants that aren't superpower mutants. They're just fucked up looking, and they live under the sewer or in the sewers under New York City. And one of their leaders was named Caliban.
Oh, wow. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Storm was involved with them too, wasn't she?
Yes, she was. Their actual leader was called Callisto.
Yeah.
And Storm and her actually fought and Callisto took over the leadership of the X-Men for a few years. But anyway, I'm sure that the writers of the X-Men took the ideas from something older, because they usually do. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that's awesome.
So there's that. Leftover thought from last week regarding the intimacy between Evelyn and Hecate. True Satanists aren't tied by morality, but rather practice indulgence according to the urges of human nature. So hedonism between family members would not be forbidden. So,
ooh.
I don't know if Dunkin' Donuts is putting forth the idea that when she calls her daughter, this could be a literal thing.
That's what it sounds like to me.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Hmm.
Oh, I'd be so effed up.
Yeah, that would just add an extra layer of, like,
ew,
fucked up and creepiness to this character. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's already... I mean, what kind of moral scruples do you have if you're going to kill a baby to take out its heart and entrails to put it in a puppet?
Look at the decor of her home.
Yeah.
It's bones. She could come out in a striper t-shirt and some like little shorts and it would be totally fine. I'd be like, right on. Hey, I would hang out there, you know.
Striper. What a reference.
I know. It's pretty good.
Do you think the final battle of the season will be on Ballantrae Moor? Ooh, that's a good question.
Maybe.
Like if she goes back to get the book and they have to follow her out there. Yeah.
That way no one else in London knows that they're all gifted. You know what I mean? Makes sense. Keep it out in the woods.
Yeah, and not have any collateral damage around.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Don't destroy all of New York City like the Avengers, maybe. But so
no, that was Superman.
That's okay, right. Yeah. Wait, no, that would have been Metropolis then. Hope you always stay very completely dressed with the collars and the black things and the Dunkin' Donuts.
Boom.
Thank
awesome.
You very, very
thank
much
you.
For
thank
the feedback.
Thank you, Dunkin' Donuts. And readers, if you like Dunkin' Donuts Insight, she actually writes a recap on Penny Dreadful, and you can find that at projectfandom.com.
Okay, I always try and retweet your tweet about it, just to kind of get it out there.
Yeah,
she definitely deserves it.
I try to retweet her blog posts, and you can, and also I share them on Facebook. But, you know, Dunkin' Donuts, it's difficult to share it on Facebook. Like, when I try to share it, I share the whole website, Project Fandom, or I don't get an image on the Facebook, but just letting you
know. Something, yeah, help us out, help you out. We're like a little family.
Yes.
Us and our listeners. We're just helping each other out constantly.
A little networking family.
Thanks to everybody who took the time to listen to us in the first place and then furthermore write something in. We really, really appreciate it. I speak for everybody in the podcast when I say this is our absolute favorite part of it, is when we get to read the feedback and engage with the listeners, and this is what makes it all worth it.
Absolutely.
Right. A lot of time and effort is put into these things. Mostly by M, but yeah, you know, sure. Yeah, but we do our little part, and but to me, this is what makes it all worth it.
Mm-hmm. And it, you know, like what Bib brought forth about, you know, the picture of Dorian Gray, if anybody has any thoughts on the books that are involved or that are associated with this, feel free to write in. Just make sure you write that it's spoilery, and we will create a spoiler section, and we can have a more in-depth discussion about, you know,
absolutely,
theories based on that kind of thing.
Hey, don't be shy. I mean, you know, it's all for fun anyway. So send whatever you want in. And if we want to throw it in, we will.
And I think it's good we had that discussion because we really hadn't put forth. Steve and I actually had discussed about how I read the book and how he knew the story, mm-hmm. how we weren't going to spoil it and things like that. But now that we've got you introduced into this podcast, we probably should have said, hey, this is how we're going to approach it. We're not going to spoil it and all that stuff. But the only podcast we spoil on is our Twin Peaks. That's because the show's been around for longer than 25 years. So
It's older than some of its viewers. So if you don't know who killed Laura Palmer at this point, we really can't have any sympathy for you.
Careful. Careful.
Yeah. It was Johnny Horn. if you want to send in any of the if people out there who have read any of the applicable books, you know, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, the Picture of Dorian Gray, who wrote that?
Oscar Wilde.
Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Mm-hmm. Twilight, Bram Stoker wrote that one.
Thank you very much. Insight and Revelations from M. Twilight will not be included in this.
So I read the wrong book. Shit. And definitely don't forget to review us on iTunes. You know, even if you don't want to write into us, take a small amount of time, click on some stars, write something nice, so, you know, we can just get our names out there even more. You don't have to send anything in. Just help us out. Please.
You know, I know there's some people out there who are listening who are thinking about writing in some feedback, but maybe they're just a little bit nervous or wary about the whole process. They haven't done it before. Whatever the reason might be, just go ahead and do it. It's more fun than you would think.
Yeah,
it's
you
fun
hear
for
some...
you. It's fun for us. Yeah. You get to hear what you had to say about the show on the podcast, and then it gets put out there, and all the other people who listen to the podcast get to hear it too. So it's just the more the merrier.
Yeah, and don't worry about it. You know, I'd say most of us say all kinds of ridiculous things throughout the podcast. So it doesn't have to be like in depth or anything. I mean, look at Bibs. It's hilarious. It's informative. Just have fun with it.
Sounds good, guys.
That's the whiskey talking.
Yes. So once again, our website is noship.net. So you can click on links to go to iTunes there, as well as to find us to write to us on our Gmail. All right, that's it.
Boom.
It's been Byzantine.
Marriage.
Yeah, this podcast was brought to you by No Ship Network.
Farewell.
We could say this.
I'm your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
And I'm your host, Paul. It doesn't work. I don't have any arts.
Neither do I.
I don't either. Farewell.
Farewell. Farewell. We're your hosts. It still doesn't work. Does she always eat butter cream for breakfast? Always.
Butter cream. I hope you have a buttercream dream.
Does she always eat buttercream?
Do you want to have buttercream dreams?
There we go. Let's just say that. Let's just say. I'm your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
And I'm your host, Paul. Careful for the bitches in the walls.
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.